The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you're just coming back from the New Orleans Investment Conference, and you had a chance to talk to the person who calls himself the 2,000-year-old man, Richard Mayberry.
Well, it is sort of when you reflect on history and look back in order to have an appreciation for current events today, look back and reflect on both the similarities that there are today as well as the lessons that we can learn from earlier periods in time, that you get the kind of perspective that Rick Mayberry brings to the picture. He's been writing his newsletter for decades and does bring that historical overlay, which is so helpful, trying to understand where we're at and where we're going.
One of the things I've always liked about Rick Mayberry, Dave, is, you know, we all need a paradigm that we look at when we're looking at history. His is unique. He's come up with a phrase called chaos Stan, and he looks at what a lot of people call, you know, the 1040 window, what have you, but it's that place on Earth as it runs across the band that really seems to create an awful lot of geopolitical chaos. Now, he does the same thing economically. He seems to look at things and name things in a way where it brings new perspective.
With us again is Richard Mayberry, and with a perspective we've always appreciated, and I think many of our listeners have as well, as subscribers to the U.S. and World Early Warning Report. Subtitle, if you will, Insights from the 2,500-Year-Old Man. The interesting thing, as many of you know from reading it for many years, is that history does stay very, very relevant and fresh, even going back to 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years, as a means by which we understand current events and their implications. How do humans choose and zig and zag in relation to events as they're unfolding? We have something of a record here, and that's why history is so important. Richard, thank you for joining us again.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You know, you point out that there's a number of things which are changing and a number of things which are constant. The two things which seem to be constant here is that the United States continues to be at war at so many different places around the world, and we continue to see currency debasement. Now, that's not something that is exclusive to the United States, but is really a global theme. Any thoughts as to why these are recurrent themes that we continue to deal with?
You mean recurrent historically over many centuries?
Yeah, war is something we just can't seem to shake, and currency debasement is something we can't seem to shake. Is the common denominator politicians?
Yeah, the common denominator is political power. I don't see the problem in terms of liberals versus conservatives or left versus right or Democrats versus Republicans, that sort of thing. I see it in terms of liberty versus power. You know, political power corrupts. There's any number of commentators over many centuries that have made that observation. You can take a perfectly intelligent, fine, honorable, upstanding person, and you stick him into politics, and 6 months later, he's a crook and a liar, and his family doesn't recognize him. He's just, you know, a real mess. The reason political power corrupts both the morals and the judgment is that it is itself corruption. Political power is the legalized privilege of using brute force on persons who have not harmed anyone, and the best example of that is taxes. But there are, you know, numerous other examples where governments are able to just reach into your life and forcibly make you do something that you wouldn't ordinarily be doing in your life just because they think that's a good thing to do. Now, governments have that privilege, but nobody else does. It's political power is the privilege that sets government apart from all other institutions. You know, churches, charities, fraternal organizations, individuals, companies, no one is allowed to initiate the use of force on another person except in self-defense. But government is allowed to do it anytime they feel like it. And that has such a terrible corrupting effect that it's a temptation that the person who's in power just cannot avoid. He eventually succumbs to it. Makes him think that he's somehow superior to other people, and he begins making stupid mistakes. And you see that all through history, which is why the commentators all through history have talked about the fact that political power corrupts. the American founders' solution to that was, well, there is no 100% solution, but there is a partial solution, and that is to keep the amount of power very, very small, so that no matter who gets control of it, he can't do much damage. But we now have a government that has, you know, using Jefferson's terms, has slipped the chains of the Constitution and is pretty much a totalitarian government. They can do anything they want. All they have to do is declare an emergency, and they're off and running toward some new scheme. And it always does. Whenever this happens in history, the government gets carried away, starts doing stupid things, and winds up with projects that are beyond its means to be able to handle. And, you know, one of those projects is wars, and then the other one will be meddling in the economy in one way or another. And the way they kind of try to patch up their mistakes in the economy is by counterfeiting money. And so you have this double trend all through history that's just carved in stone, which is more war and more currency debasement until the government is in a crisis situation and you have some sort of revolution. And my newsletter, Early Warning Report, has been reporting about this and making suggestions for coping with it for well over 20 years. And, you know, so far we've been making a lot of money because we stick to those two trends. We try to make investment suggestions and other kinds of financial suggestions that are based on those two carved in granite trends. We don't assume that we can predict other kinds of trends, but we sure can predict those two trends.
Richard, there's an interesting issue here in that double trend, more war and more currency debasement. Right now, we have evidence of credit expansion, which is today's modern version of running the printing presses, inherently should be inflationary, and yet we have velocity of money, that is the turnover of currency, the footprint of a dollar, if you will, in the economy, at six-decade lows. So there really is little evidence of inflation. Of course, they've changed the metrics by which they measure inflation. Well familiar with that. Maybe it is officially 1.6 to 1.8, while actually 8 to 10. But just taking their numbers, let's talk about velocity. Let's talk about the perception in the marketplace, because these perceptions are very powerful. They lead people to believe, oh, well, we should be in equities today. General equity space, that's where we should be. Gold, well, that's kind of unnecessary given the fact that there is no inflation. Maybe why don't you dive in on velocity and we can meander around a little bit.
Right. One of the things that comes out of this double trend one that you see all the time is that governments eventually debase their currency to the point that velocity breaks loose from being stable and the government really no longer controls what happens because the population is spending the money differently than they did before and they are spending it in ways that are not predictable. And velocity refers to the speed at which money changes hands, and that is an indicator of money demand. You know, the financial press now pays quite a bit of attention to money supply. You see lots of articles still about that. Back when I was young, they did not. They didn't understand the connection between rising prices and rising money supply, but they pretty much have that now. And so they do report on it, but they still don't say much of anything about money demand. And money demand is the other, you know, if you will, the flip side of the coin of money supply. If there's a supply of money, there must be a demand for it. Well, what is that demand? And how much do people really want to have the money as opposed to having, let's say, goods and services? And that factor, that demand for money, is governed by fear. If they are afraid that the value of the money will decline, then they will have less demand for the money. They will try to trade it away more quickly than if they have confidence in the value of the money. And so when they accept, let's say, a dollar from somebody in trade, they are at that time, or maybe later, are deciding whether or not to get rid of it quickly or whether or not to hang on to it. And that is measured mostly by the turnover of the money, the way how fast it changes hands. Now, what's happened in the United States and around the world, I suspect, pretty much everywhere, is that we've got an unusual manifestation of this money demand. the world is pretty much still more afraid of other currencies than they are of the dollar, and so the dollar is something that they've been running to when they get scared. And so they have been grabbing hold of their dollars and hanging on more tightly for, five years now. And this tends to nullify the increases in the money supply that the Federal Reserve has been creating. And the Fed, no matter how much money they pump into the economy, which ordinarily would cause prices to rise, they seem to get very little effect from it because people are hanging on to the money. It's the same as if the Federal Reserve had a big airplane and they flew over your house and they dropped $1 million into your backyard. But you are so scared of what the federal government will do next, because you have no idea what these crazy powerful people will do next. You're so scared that you don't spend $1 million. You gather it all up and you take it to your garage and you put it in your garage and you store it there. Because when people are scared, they want to run to some form of cash. So, people are hoarding their money, essentially, and they feel that the government might do something crazy, and they're going to need that cash to help protect them in the face of whatever it is the government does. So the government, while at the same time it's increasing the money supply, it's increasing the fear supply, and people are hanging on to the money instead of spending it. So it's not having an inflationary effect on the economy, because that money that's stashed in your garage isn't having an effect on anything. You're not spending it. It does not affect prices or wages or anything else. It's just sitting there. In the modern economy today, that money is in the banks, and it's just staying in the banks because, the bankers are afraid to lend it and the borrowers are afraid to borrow it. Now, the Fed keeps printing money, $85 billion a month. They are continuing to pump into the economy, which means there is this enormous overhang of money that's in the financial system that's just sitting there doing nothing. And we cannot expect that condition to last forever. The day will come when the fear will decline for some reason. And it could be a very trivial reason. You might have, for instance, Janet Yellen, when she comes into office, she may give some sort of wildly inspirational speech about how everything's going to be okay. And it might be so convincing to most of the population that they'll go out and spend their money. And you'll have this $2.8 trillion avalanche into the economy of all, this money that's been printed just suddenly being poured into the economy by the people who aren't so afraid anymore. And in my opinion, all of this is just one man's opinion. That's what economics is. It's a very soft science. But in my opinion, we are set up for a runaway inflation that could hit at any time in practically an overnight situation, where you just go from what we have today, consumer prices rising at somewhere between 1% and 5%, let's say, that could be rising at more than 100% a week from now. All it will take is an increase in optimism among the populations and for those dollars to avalanche into the economy. And you're on your way. It's a hyperinflation that's there, a potential hyperinflation that will become a reality when people become optimistic.
I had an interesting conversation with a gentleman from Turkey just the other day, and his comments on the gold market in Turkey were fascinating. He said, it's every day that you go to their marketplace, and there's 500 major vendors under, one market area. And it's a little bit like what you'd find in Dubai with the gold souk there and many places that you'll find also in Hong Kong and India and whatnot. And it seems that we have the happy holders holding on to U.S. dollars here, but the opinion is different in other parts of the world. And maybe there's a greater suspicion of those managing the rupee, managing the Turkish lira, managing the yuan. And more people are interested in being happy holders of ounces, that is physical gold, elsewhere in the world, as opposed to in the United States, where, as you describe, it's a dollar bias. If you're afraid, you go to greenbacks. So if you have this increase in optimism and money starts coming out of the mattresses, so to say, that at the front edge is going to seem like an increase in economic activity and maybe even a full-blown economic recovery. What you're suggesting is that immediately behind it are the consequences which could be super inflationary in nature.
Yes, absolutely. You'll have this period where everything looks like it's going to be really fantastic, that finally, you know, the recovery has arrived and life is going to be wonderful for everybody. And that will feed on itself. People who feel that way will be more inclined to let go of their money. They'll go out and start buying things, and companies will start hiring. The unemployment rate will drop precipitously, and it will just look like Obama has worked a miracle. And it'll look that way for maybe a few weeks. And then everybody will notice that, gee, prices are sure starting to rise. And at some point, they will get through their heads that their dollars are losing value and they better let go of them in a hurry, trade them for something real before they lose even more value. And then there will be this stampede to start spending money. Now, a factor that's new here that I don't think that very many people have looked at is the internet. It used to be that, you know, the word about what was happening in the economy took a while to get around, and that the individual on the street who was, you never learned very much of anything about economics, he was in the dark all the time, and he was always taking a bath in one way or another, because he just didn't know what was happening. Well, today he's going to know what's happening. There will be material on the internet that will explain to him why his money is losing value. And so the odds of the money deteriorating slowly, I don't think, are anywhere close to the odds of it just crashing over a period of a few days or weeks. And I think that's the really big kicker. You know, the Fed thinks that they can do something about this, that they can withdraw enough money quickly enough to stop a runaway inflation. But I really rather doubt it now. Everything these days moves at the speed of an electron, and I don't think they're going to be fast enough when it really cuts loose.
You know, we've talked a little bit about money. We've talked about the debasement that occurs, has, and continues to. We've talked about velocity being flat and the increase of velocity bringing about a major inflation with the liquidity, the credit that's already been created. One thing we haven't talked about is sort of current politics. And you know, you look at the Affordable Care Act, obviously a misnomer, but there's political consequences potentially here in the midterm. If you had to look ahead and say who wins and who loses as a consequence of sort of this attempt by government to step into 1/6 of the economy. I mean, almost a, you know, a forced takeover of 1/6 of the economy. Maybe that succeeds, maybe it doesn't. How do you think it plays from here?
I think we will have periods when it looks like things are getting better. But basically, the reason there is no more Union of Soviet Socialist Republics is that socialism doesn't work. You know, we are set up now for this situation where the federal government is trying to force a new layer of socialism into the medical industry that's so enormous that it doesn't have a prayer of surviving except in a very mangled form. And it's hard to imagine how effectively governments can screw up things like medical industries when they decide to do good. They have an astounding capacity for it. And it comes from the fact that they're using brute force. Now, there's another even more fundamental reason why this situation with the medical industry cannot turn out well, and that is that it violates the very principle of insurance. This idea of medical insurance came about in the United States during World War II when there were wage controls, and the manufacturers knew that they had to be able to raise wages because the government was debasing the dollar. And they went to Roosevelt and said, you know, we've got to find some way to be able to raise wages. You've gone and capped wages, and we can't cope with this, the inflation of the dollar. And Roosevelt came up with this idea, well, we'll give them a disguised wage increase in the form of free medical insurance. and that's where Kaiser Permanente came from. It was the first organization to offer this free medical insurance through the employers to the workers as a way of getting around the wage controls, just beating the wage control. Roosevelt set that up, and ever since then, people have had this idea that you're supposed to have this thing called medical insurance, where all of your medical needs are taken care of, health insurance. Well, let's take another analogy.
Come back to that analogy in just a second. It dawns on me that what you're describing was originally a coverage which ensured that nothing catastrophic could impact a family and sort of take them out of the economic equation, destroying them completely from an economic or financial standpoint. It seems to me that we've morphed from that into something that's more like a medical service contract,
yeah,
where even down to the smallest hangnail, we expect to step in and with a $25 copay, get professional care from an MD for said hangnail. I mean, so that this concept of insurance really has gone from the catastrophic to the service contract, which is unsustainable in on any scale.
Right. Insurance is very simply, it's we can use as an example house insurance. If your house burns down, you've got insurance, and the insurance company pays off and rebuilds your house. Well, what that is that houses burning down are a catastrophic thing, but they're a rare thing. Very few people ever experience it. So everybody is covered by the fact that we each put a little bit of money into a pot somewhere, which is the insurance company, once a year, and then the people who do have house fires get their houses rebuilt for them out of the pot. It only works as long as house fires are a rare thing. If everybody had house fires, then you couldn't get very much money out of the pot. So that's how insurance works. That's how it has always worked, as a way of sharing or spreading the risk throughout the population so that everybody takes a very small hit in order that a few people can be covered when they take a big hit. Well, what this medical insurance has evolved into is this assumption that everything about your health should be taken care of through this insurance. And that's the same thing as having house insurance that covers everything that can go wrong with a house, not just a fire, but light bulbs burning out and crabgrass growing in your lawn, plumbing leaks, other minor kinds of things. Well, everybody has those problems. So there's no way you can have everybody putting a small amount of money in the pot and then everybody also taking out the money for these things that are very common and that happen to everybody. It's not economically possible to do. It's just a straightforward mathematical fact that you cannot have comprehensive health care insurance. It cannot exist. And so the government is in the business of trying to make something that can't exist, exist. And no matter how hard they try, it's going to bust. There's just no way that this thing can work. And they're going to default on the whole thing at some point down the road. We don't know when, but they're trying to create something that is impossible. So that's an even more fundamental fact about the medical care situation that you have to keep in mind, that there can't be insurance for everything. There just can't. And they won't swallow that fact. They have this idea that because you're human, you have a right to medical insurance. Well, what they're saying is you have a right to something that can't exist, and they're going to try to make it exist. So I can't imagine anything more crazy than this situation, and it's only going to keep getting worse as they try to fix it, because it can't be fixed. No matter what they do, they cannot make the math work out.
Yeah, if this is an example of governmental overreach and what ultimately is unsustainable, this current scale and the future scale and scope of government, Leviathan has grown and continues to, you know, it seems that there is a question ahead. When you get to a period of crisis, you know, financial and economic crisis, it's not uncommon to have that followed by a period of political and even geopolitical crisis. And, you know, we may play the blame game and say, hey, well, it's the Chinese. They're not, you know, participating or manipulating their currency. They're to blame. Let's say we don't point the finger at someone else across the border. but the blame game gets played inside our own borders. You know, the revolution, and it was very different than that of 1789 in France. Maybe you could, one, comment on the differences between those two revolutions, and two, are we moving unavoidably towards something like revolution in the United States yet again?
I think we definitely are. Actually, I think we're in the early stages of it. The comparison between 1776 and 1789 is one of my favorite ones. I, from studying history for back 2,500 years, what I see is a pattern in which revolutions usually go in one of two directions. Sometimes they go in the direction of 1776, which is an overthrow of the government, a severe shrinkage of the government until its power is much, much less. And you have a new era of liberty that breaks out, and the system of liberty produces great prosperity for everybody. The other direction is 1789, which was the French Revolution. And the French Revolution led to the so-called Reign of Terror, in which mobs were just massacring people indiscriminately. And that was then followed by the Napoleonic Wars, because the French had Napoleon come to power, and he set off to conquer the world. Those are the two directions they generally go in, either a great reduction in the power of the government or a great increase in the power of the government. The United States today, I was very gloomy about it, let's say 10 years ago, but there has been such a magnificent increase in the interest in the system of liberty now over the last 10 years. It's just almost miraculous in my mind, especially when you look back to, let's say, 1920s and 30s, when socialism was taking over the world. At that time, there were the number of professional libertarians was three or four, or maybe a half a dozen. You had Ludwig von Mises, Friedrich Hayek, Henry Hazlitt. Those were the three leading lights at that time, and then there were a few other people. And that was it. Probably the whole libertarian philosophy and movement boiled down to a dozen people at the most. The philosophy of the American founders was only being held alive by that group of people, and that's in the whole world I'm talking about. And in 1946, they created the Foundation for Economic Education, and that began the growth of the revival of the interest in the system of liberty. And it just stumbled along and made very, very slow progress decade after decade after decade until you get to the 21st century. And my gosh, it has just exploded now. It's just astounding how fast it's growing. So I'm getting more and more optimistic that this thing is going to go in the right direction, that it really is going to go in the direction of 1776. There's going to be an economic catastrophe that will be so awful, it will cause the population to say, you know, where did we go wrong? We've got to back up and start over and get back to the economic model that produced the Industrial Revolution in the United States and made the United States the leader of the world for so long. And I think that, again, as I say, that the movement is growing really fast because pretty much everybody realizes now something is really seriously wrong with this socialist model that was crammed down our throats during the 20th century. The great worldwide socialist experiment is falling apart. That grew up at the end of the 1800s and in the early 1900s, that it came to maturity and it just swept the world. And the whole world went into this socialist experiment, and it just kept making things worse and worse until it demolished the American system. And we're living with the results of that now. The trouble you see all around the world is the socialist experiment collapsing. So I'm expecting, and of course I could be wrong, again, this is just one man's opinion here, but I'm expecting to see revolutions in practically every country, because every country, in one way or another, to some extent, tried a socialist model, and it's falling apart everywhere. And the people have been taught for decades and decades that the government will take care of them, the government is the solution to their problems. the government is their own personal superhero like Batman and Wonder Woman, and it will take care of them. And there's trouble now, and the government's not taking care of them. It's welching on that promise in every country. And I think that these people all realize, or coming to realize, you know, millions of them already do realize they've been defrauded, that the socialist promise was empty. And they're angry, and that spells revolution. And I think there will be a revolution in pretty much every country. And some, I hope, will go in the direction of 1776. Probably a lot of them will go in the direction of 1789, the Reign of Terror.
We had in, you know, the last 20, 30 years an increase in the socialist experiment, and it seems to be moving that direction, you know, where government is getting bigger, not smaller. And I would agree with you, the experiment is failing, and we're seeing sort of fractures even within the economy, a greater recurrence, more rapid recurrence of major financial problems. Now, three crises within about a 10-year period, which frankly in the last 100 years is unheard of. So things are beginning to come unglued, and the ability to control, manipulate growth, smooth the business cycle, all of these things sort of in the top-down experiment are coming unglued. But wouldn't you also say that as the powers that be begin to lose control, you begin to see behavior which is much more vindictive and much more vitriolic, much more dangerous? And in that regard, couldn't you expect the Leviathan to do everything it can to stay alive? And what kind of behavior might we see? How do we sort of prepare for, you know, the last gasps of the Western welfare state?
Well, my newsletter, Early Warning Report, is kind of changing its emphasis a little bit to deal with exactly that question. Well, I think I've been warning for all these years that this day was coming, and now I'm thinking the day is here. And so there's an imperative to get ready yourself personally to ride through this period of turmoil. So we are adjusting our mix of information now a little to help people get by, not only financially with their investments and all, but also physically. You have to make preparations here. There's going to be trouble. There's going to be, I think it's a lead pipe cinch, that there are going to be riots in all the big cities. And you've got to be ready to ride through that. And, you know, that will involve, for instance, the cutoff of food supplies for a while, and maybe water supplies. All sorts of things are going to go wrong, and they're not going to last forever. I'm not a doom and gloomer. I don't think this is the end of the world. But, you know, big history didn't stop just because we happened to be born. This is another one of the situations that you read about in history books. It's going to be really big, and it's not going to be fun for a while. So you want to be prepared for it. In all of the other catastrophes that have happened in history, there have been some people who have come out of them in very good shape and even much more wealthy than when they went in. And I see my job with my newsletter is to help people get through this and come out in good shape and maybe even be a lot richer. It's possible to do because it always has been done in catastrophes before. So the first thing you want to be thinking to is the safety of your family. All of life's necessities you want to have a stock of, food, water, medicines, and on, have a lot of blankets, very basic necessity type stuff. You want to be ready to be self-sufficient for some number of weeks or months. You want to have the ability to defend yourself and be trained for that. It's a very big subject. There's a new movement in the country that's referred to generally as the preparationists or the preppers. These are people who are, they're not the old survivalists. It's a new group. It's very largely made up of professionals, doctors, lawyers, people who are highly educated and have good incomes, and they are making preparations. They see that something very bad could happen, and they are making preparations to get their families through them comfortably. And I think everybody should be a preparationist, and, you know, to the extent that you can be, because big things happen in history, and I think it's, you know, another one's going to happen here, and it's going to happen not only in the United States but all around the world.
Well, Richard, we would agree with that, the notion that big things do happen in history, and if you're not nimble, if you haven't given some thought to the future, though you can't predict it. As Pericles said, you can certainly prepare for it. We would agree there are changes coming. Maybe just a last comment as we wrap up today. You know, what we've talked about, maybe it has something of a somber tone to it, but the stock market today is putting in new all-time highs, which if that's any indication of what lies ahead, you could argue quite the opposite to our conversation. Happy days are here again. And it's only tulips and sunshine tomorrow, which we can expect. I mean, listen, we've got, you know, gold on its back, $1,250, $1,300 an ounce in that range, which again, an indication that all is well. The stock market, which is at all-time highs, again, an indication that all is well. Is it possible that we're simply insane and see these concerns and are frankly blowing them up out of proportion, or is there another possibility that we have a reality out there that simply is fiction? That is, the stock market does not represent the economy, and it does represent the footprint of the Fed, leveraged speculation, but not really an all-clear signal in terms of the U.S. or global economy.
Yeah, again, as I said earlier, economics is a soft science, and there's no guarantee that we're right. There's a lot about economics we don't know. But I would point out the Federal Reserve doesn't know it, too. They are flying blind. They don't know what they're doing. Now, if you have trouble believing that this is a new situation, I would urge you to get on the St. Louis Federal Reserve's website and look at their statistics on the monetary base and go back as far as you can. Their numbers go back to, like, World War I and or close to it. And look at that chart and try to tell yourself that something hasn't changed. It's just, it's stark. It's amazing what's been going on in the last 4 or 5 years. And that chart shows it to you. And that's a chart of the money that is backed up in the banking system waiting to come out. And the government, the Federal Reserve, is still injecting $85 billion per month into the economy, despite what you see in that chart. To my mind, you've got to be a real Pollyanna to look at that chart and not see a catastrophe coming.
In a nutshell, the monetary base is your commercial bank reserves and currency in circulation. And for anyone looking at the chart, it's one of the few that you'll see as relatively stable from 1940 forward. And then all of a sudden, circa 2007, 2008, it literally explodes off the right side of the page.
Yeah. Right.
That's one that we've certainly used in our presentations before, but is, you're right, without precedent.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you look at, for instance, real estate prices that have been rising recently and stock prices that have been rising recently, I think what you're seeing there is the first movement of that avalanche. Those prices are rising because some money is starting to come out of the banks and circulate, and it's chasing real estate and stocks, which should be no surprise because the Fed announced a year ago that they planned to accomplish exactly that. That they were going to inject enough money to cause a boom in stocks and real estate. They said that specifically. So this is no big surprise here. And again, I think that what you're seeing is the money starting to move out of the bank. So the avalanche is starting to creep. And when it's going to cut loose completely, I don't know. But it's very likely to lead to an economic catastrophe that will lead to a revolution. And I do not use that word revolution lightly. When my wife and I were first married back in the 60s, we lived in Central America, and we went through two revolutions. So, you know, I know what I'm talking about when I use the word revolution, and I don't want to do that again. Believe me, that's a horrible situation. But, you know, I think it's going to happen around the world, and you know, because people will only tolerate just so much before they rise up. And it's going to be nasty in a lot of places. It's not going to last forever. It's only going to be temporary, but it's going to be nasty, and you want to be ready to ride through it.
Richard, it was less than a 10-year period, 1789 to 1796, that the French assignat, the currency of the day, went from being full value to being worth nothing. And it was right in the middle of that, about a 60% way through, 50% way through that period, both of time and appreciation, 1793, when the head started to roll. 17,000 heads. The nobility was blamed for the inflation. There was social chaos. Everyone searching for an answer as to why they were experiencing pain, personal dislocation, unemployment, desperation, inability to feed the mouths at home, and somebody had to be blamed. I would agree with you, there are inklings. There are inklings of a more positive outcome, but a real tussle ahead in terms of the socialist welfare state wanting and driving towards one particular outcome, and in it not being a guarantee that we do end up with a 1776 consequence, one where, as you described earlier, we have liberty as a consequence. We have shrinkage in government. We have opportunity for all versus just the politically connected, those connected to a top-down oriented state. But I would suggest that for those not familiar with Richard Maybury's early warning report, begin with a sample copy. I think you're $15 per copy for back issues, and would suggest getting a regular subscription to the U.S. World Early Warning Report. It's a fantastic, again, look at history as we wrap up. You know, your last letter looked at Rome and a number of the challenges faced, the colossal destruction which occurred in the Roman Empire, but also a look at how grand, in fact, the accomplishments were of the Roman Empire. You know, industrial sophistication in that day and age, which was not rivaled until the 1800s in Europe. And so to think that greatness only goes one direction, you know, and technological innovation is inexorably on a multiplied future growth curve, that's not always the way it happens. And we appreciate your perspective. We appreciate the historical tie-ins. And today we hope that your cold quickly passes and you're feeling better tomorrow.
Well, thank you very much. I would like to point out, on our website right now, we're running a special offer for subscriptions where you can get it at just a little above half price, I believe. So people might want to take a look at the website, too, and that's Richard Maybury, M-A-Y-B-U-R-Y, but you can also spell it M-A-Y-B-E-R-R-Y, too, and it'll still work.
M-A-Y-B-U-R-Y.com, that's RichardMayberry.com, and would strongly consider the subscription to your letter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much. It was a good time.
One of the things, David, that you've been talking about as you have been traveling the country and on national and international TV is the lack of velocity in the money. I mean, you can print all the money you want, but if it's not moving from hand to hand, it's not necessarily creating any kind of economic growth. It seems like Rick Maybury is looking at the same thing.
That's right. The transmission mechanism in the banking system is broken, and right now the liquidity that has been created by the Fed is not working its way into the economy. The deception here, the deceiving element, is that as and when it begins to come into the economy, at the front edge, it will look like economic recovery. It'll look like robust economic growth, and yet what you have in terms of sort of the tide coming in is the tidal wave that follows it, the deluge of liquidity, which represents super or even hyperinflation. Now, does that become an event that we're cognizant or concerned about in sort of a period 2016 to 2017? It may not be immediate. We have still these sort of deflationary trends in place, a tremendous amount of debt, potentially an unwind selectively of debt. We've already seen that in Puerto Rico in terms of their bond market. We're beginning to see other pockets of weakness in the debt markets. But that doesn't mean that we have a complete deflationary collapse. And yet those deflationary concerns remain. Perhaps it is sort of a 2016-2017 timeframe where the inflationary impact of the monetary policies which are already in place and are being reinforced by Janet Yellen as she brings her leadership to the Fed will be something that is, again, sort of consequential into the future. Now, I think one of the things that we talked about today with Rick so important is this notion that there are political and geopolitical consequences to the current financial issues. And, you know, while we talk about revolution and the potential for revolution, frankly, we don't know that that's the way it does play out. Perhaps it is, again, going back to the conversation we had with Neil Howe, the author of The Fourth Turning, there is this idea that when you get to the final season of growth and then ultimately sort of a roiling in the political system, sometimes you do, in fact, have a revolution in the streets, and it is sort of domestic in its orientation, as Rick Maybury was talking about today. And sometimes it's international and you sort of blame the neighbor and you have the accusatory finger pointed at someone else. And that's, again, it remains to be seen how this plays out. But over the next 3 to 5 years, much of what Rick is concerned about and what we talked about today will become more obvious.
Well, David, this brings into perspective again the way that Rick looks at the world. He looks in a historic pattern. He says, all right, from empire to empire, how do things start? How do they grow? And how do they end? And, you know, I was talking to my wife the other day saying, you know, as long as this country respects the rule of law, and as long as we understand that the Constitution and law is what keeps us from bloodshed, we still have hope. And, of course, no one's talking here about revolution in this country, and I certainly hope it doesn't happen. But we want to make sure that we keep the focus on what has made us civilized up to this point.
Well, you're exactly right, Kevin. I mean, the respect for the rule of law, the upholding of the Constitution, these are things that keep everyone on an equal playing field. And to the degree that we lose that respect for the rule of law and respect for the Constitution, then you do see the abuse of power. You have what Frederick Bastiat described as plunder legalized, but clearly still immoral.
Well, David, from this point forward, you're moving now, I believe, to Shanghai. You're going to spend time there at the Shanghai Exchange. I'm looking forward to talking to you then. Do you have any comments for the listeners until we hear from you in Shanghai?
Well, you know, the notion that the power in the gold market has moved from the West to the East is something that we are very intrigued by, very concerned by, and ultimately do see that being a trend that continues on for the next 2, 3, 4 years and is a defining factor in not only the price of gold, but really the reconstitution of the world monetary system. And this is one of the reasons why we will be spending time in Shanghai next week. And if you want to join us for next week's commentary, it'll be live from Shanghai as we interview folks from the China National Gold Exchange, the Shanghai Gold Exchange, the World Gold Council, their division in Asia, and just look as much as we can under the hood to see exactly how this new system of gold demand and distribution is operating in that part of the world.
Well, in the meantime, David, happy Thanksgiving and safe travels.
Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Richard Mayberry. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.